Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in.
We know that now more than ever, people are looking for ways to work out at home or create their own little gym setups at home. One of the companies that Jen and I have found that we absolutely love and almost exclusively use to build our home gym is PRX Performance Equipment. Go check them out at the link in the show notes. They have so many innovative ways to just use products and use your space wisely. They have racks that you can put weights on that fold up into the wall and all sorts of wall storage. So even if you have a small space, you can still make it feel big with the products that they have. They have dumbbells, they have bands, they have kettlebells, they have just about anything that you would want to put in your home gym. So again, it's what Jen and I use in our homes. We absolutely love the quality of the product. And of course, it's going to be able to get you a heck of a workout in. So check out the link in the show notes, get yourself some PRX Performance Equipment, and let's head into the episode.
We have some physical therapists on the podcast too, actually joining us today. So this is going to be an exciting PT conversation. But we're really going to go into the importance of why physical therapy, especially if you have back pain. Why would you go see a physical therapist first? Now, they have a book called Movers and Mentors, and they actually interviewed me as a person in there, which I'm very honored. But one of them is Tim Reynolds. He's a PT, and he is an assistant professor in anatomy and physiology at Ithaca College and a part-time physical therapist practicing at Cayuga Medical Center in Ithaca, New York, where he predominantly treats patients that have spine or lower extremity impairments or diagnoses. And so he earned his Doctor of Physical Therapy degree from Ithaca College back in 2014, and he actually completed both his orthopedic residency and spine fellowship through Cayuga Medical Center and currently helps to mentor and teach both of these programs as well.
And we also have Dr. Brian Guzke, who's an outpatient orthopedic physical therapist practicing in Rochester, New York, working primarily with patients in spine-related issues and persistent pain. Brian earned his Doctor of Physical Therapy degree from Ithaca College in 2014, completed an orthopedic residency program with the Cayuga Medical Center in 2015, and received his Orthopedic Clinical Specialist certification, and also earned a Master of Business Administration degree from Simon Business School at University of Rochester in 2021. So these guys are just so knowledgeable in back pain and also talk about why words matter and why the words that your providers use matter and how you should kind of pay attention to that. So let's get going with the interview.
Hello, Tim and Brian. Thank you for being here. Other PTs that we're always so appreciative to have on the podcast and drop knowledge beyond what Dom and I try to do. And you guys are really like truly in it. We've quite honestly been out of practice, especially with moving around and having our wedding all of last year. It was just like, we haven't really seen patients.
Yeah, I feel like a poser sometimes because I graduated in 2018 and I'm already, you know, more than a year out almost of seeing patients directly. So I miss it. I miss being in the clinic.
I know. So thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, guys.
For sure. And so, you know, I kind of just want to start, like, I look at what I would call your rap sheets. And it's pretty impressive. You guys have both, you know, gone through residency. You continue to get more continuing ed. The stuff that you're doing now, talking about language and what you should look for in how a provider talks to somebody and delivers information to their patient. You know, I really respect a lot of that work. And Tim, I just kind of want to get an idea of why you ended up in the area you're working with people that are dealing with back pain and spinal issues. And can you talk a little bit into that?
Yeah, Dom. So my name is Tim Reynolds. I'm a graduate from Ithaca College back in 2014. And I currently am in a professor teaching anatomy physiology at Ithaca College now. When I was done with physical therapy school, I went and did a postdoctorate orthopedic residency at Cayuga Medical Center located in Ithaca, New York, which gave me sort of a further specialization in orthopedics. And then once I became an employee for Cayuga Med, I went and did a spine fellowship, which was a two-year spine fellowship. So I had the opportunity to further specialize in individuals with low back pain. But one of the benefits of the program, in addition to sort of learning from a didactic coursework standpoint and gaining more knowledge about different treatment paradigms, was the mentorship opportunities. And so I had the opportunity to learn how to communicate more effectively, because I think when we think about pathology in general, if I jammed my finger or rolled my ankle, I feel like the general population can handle that. That doesn't really get us overly nervous. We might be a little bit upset for a couple of days. But there's such a stigma associated with back pain. And it's traumatizing and it can really affect people's lives. And so I think being able to combine both my knowledge base in terms of treatment with individuals with low back pain with this association of this mindfulness of word choice has really sort of enhanced my practice.
I think that's so beautiful. And I'm excited to dive in, one, to why residency, why you chose where you are. But I'd love to hear from you as well, Brian. And I guess I want to hear from both of you. Why residency? Because that was a big question coming out of PT school. Who's going to go to residency? Who's going to go to fellowship? And I know some of my classmates who have, and I know a lot who haven't. And personally, I was even told from some of my mentors, what is the benefit, you know, of having more letters behind your name? The only person who knows about what those letters are really are other physical therapists, not other patients. And really, you know, we always are continuing to learn. So do we need that residency? Do we need that fellowship? Like, what was the reasoning for why you both kind of went into that?
Yeah. So I am currently in Rochester, New York, treating in a for the University of Rochester Medical Center. So it's an outpatient orthopedic hospital-based setting. But, you know, kind of going back to when, you know, Tim and I went through residency together at KV Medical Center, as he mentioned. And I think we both kind of came to the conclusion, you know, as we were kind of working through our final clinical affiliations and starting to manage a full caseload, I myself seemed to have more questions than answers at that point. So I was still curious about a lot of things. I didn't feel totally comfortable. Tim and I on some other podcasts and just other conversations have talked about this concept of imposter syndrome. And I definitely felt that a little bit. And to this day, still feel it sometimes. And I think all medical professionals, to some extent, have a little bit of that, depending on what their roles and responsibilities are. But I definitely had that coming out of school. And you know, after having some conversations and our residency director, Mike Costello, who was both a great mentor or who was a mentor for Tim and I, you know, came and talked to us and basically gave us some information on residency programs and said you'd gain 5 years of experience in 1 year doing a residency track. And at that point, I was pretty much sold. I knew I wanted to get better, serve my patients better, just be more knowledgeable in the orthopedic space, because that's what I was interested in. So that was kind of my reasoning and my why behind going into a residency program.
Yeah, and I think, Jen and Dom, it's sort of the same kind of concept. We graduate from physical therapy school with this general knowledge base, right? We're trained in cardiopulmonary pathologies, we're trained in musculoskeletal, neurological conditions. And so you have this sort of blanket, if you would, treatment paradigms that you're able to work within. And knowing that I wanted to go into the orthopedic space, I didn't necessarily feel overly confident that I was going to be able to provide the skill set that my patients required and that I was going to give them the best that I was capable of doing. And I think there's that opportunity that it takes, the saying that it takes 21 years to become 21. So the idea that you have to get your reps in with your patients in order to improve your treatment outcomes. But at the same time, like Brian said, I had a chance to talk to Mike Costello, one of my mentors, John Winslow, one of my mentors, and the confidence that they had in terms of, well, with the mentorship opportunities and the continuation in coursework, you'll probably gain several years of clinical experience just because we're going to sort of inundate you with all this orthopedic knowledge. And so for me, that seemed like too good of an opportunity to pass up. And looking back on my sort of clinical career, that residency decision served as a stepping stone for so many other opportunities. Yes, the letters were nice, having an OCS after your name, does, I guess, make you feel like you can pat yourself on the back at times. But at the same time, even if I didn't get that nomenclature, if you would, I think the experiences, the connections, and the mentorship opportunities that I had was worth every penny of it.
That's great. And Brian, I love what you brought up about this, you know, imposter syndrome or this thing that I think a lot of people feel in physical therapy, but in many professions, that you've definitely got the skill set, you've got the education to start seeing patients. But as soon as you graduate and get thrown into a clinic, wherever you're at, an orthopedic clinic, I feel like a lot of students just feel like they get run over because they don't necessarily feel like they have the time to go home and research more or do more continuing ed to feel like they're doing justice for their patients just in order to keep their head above water. Do you feel like after doing that residency, some of that imposter syndrome melted away?
Yeah, definitely. I think coming out of school, I was dealt a lot of it. You know, I mean, looking at a full caseload coming out of school, you might be really confident in managing 50% of that caseload, maybe less, depending on, you know, what you're seeing. And I definitely felt that. Just this sentiment of, you know, I'm not the right one to be seeing this patient. This patient should be seeing somebody else, a different provider, a more experienced provider. I'm not the right person for the job. That was definitely a challenge. And after going through residency program and getting essentially kind of force fed the most up to date evidence and kind of the best treatment management principles, if you will, definitely felt a lot more confident. But there's always still, you know, a little bit of that. And you know, you'll catch a patient on your schedule where those feelings of, man, this patient should be really be seeing our shoulder specialist or this or that person. Those feelings do come, and you kind of lights a little bit of a fire to go back and hit the books, hit the research, and kind of come up with a better plan. But definitely the residency program helped with that for sure.
Yeah. And so I kind of want to talk into this area a lot, both of you kind of working now with back pain and spinal diagnoses or what have you. And how exactly might the listener know if the PT that they're seeing or the back pain that they're experiencing is something that is going to resolve? I know back pain can be something that's very emotional, and a lot of people feel it for a long time and start to have chronic issues versus just an acute case or a, you know, back injury that's just an acute case. And I know a lot of back pains, you know, research will say in the acute sense will resolve. So I guess my question is, how can somebody know if just going to another physical therapist is going to help with their back issue versus trying to seek somebody out who might have a little bit more education in that area?
Well, I think, Dom, one of the pieces of literature that came out showed that early intervention for the treatment of individuals from a physical therapy standpoint was better than waiting, right? And so I think it's one of those things that, yes, obviously one PT is not necessarily equivalent to the other PT. I think having the opportunity to sort of vet your PT, kind of like you would sort of explore who your orthopedic surgeon would be, for instance, is important. But I think the knowledge and skill set that a lot of our upcoming graduates and current practitioners have would be better than trying to navigate some of this stuff on your own. I think society as a whole puts out a lot of information, and some of it's valid information, but with the sort of social media influence that people can post information that's not necessarily accurate. If we believed everything that we saw on the internet, then everybody's core would be extremely weak, and that's the source for their back. And I think one of the biggest things, or one of the biggest misnomers that I hear, is that back pain can just be treated by strengthening your core. I think there's an element to improving your, and I'm going to put air quotes around, sort of lumbopelvic coordination or control. But you can't necessarily plank your way out of back pain. And I think that's one of the things that, just from a general population standpoint, all back pain is not created equal. There's not a cookbook that you can just flip to the back pain chapter and just throw a couple exercises at it and guarantee that it's going to go away.
That is literally the hardest thing, is I get questions just blanket, you know, what do I do for my back pain? I'm like, I have no idea. I don't know. You tell me what you should do for your back pain, because it'd be better than me telling you.
One of a million different things.
So it's just so wild. And I think, you know, what also is there is, I think, still a disconnect, even like you're saying, I mean, talking about just core for back pain, for me, that feels such old school way of thinking, but it's still something that's very, very common, right? And I think something that is still very, very common, which isn't necessarily wrong or bad, but it's my back hurts. I need to go see my chiropractor and get realigned. Like, how does someone start to learn, like, well, my physical therapist can also be a first line of action? And why would someone see a PT over a chiro?
That's a great question, Jen. And I think both chiropractors and physical therapists alike are really trying to just help the patient and do the best by them with the skill set that they have. But a little shameless plug for physical therapy here. There's a kind of mounting evidence. We're seeing these big kind of healthcare system studies where they're compiling a lot of data, a lot of outcomes, and, you know, looking back and seeing which patients did what differently. And what we're finding is that patients that saw a physical therapist before seeing any type of primary care physician or specialist ended up having a significantly less chance of having to get an injection, get an MRI, go through advanced treatments, see other practitioners. So PTs and kind of movement specialists as a first line of defense, if you will, after an acute onset of low back pain or neck pain, end up doing much better and spending a lot less, both on the healthcare side, but also on their personal finance side as well, on further treatments or further intervention. So seeing a movement specialist first can kind of help tone down the situation, if you will, and educate the patient on what the kind of next steps are and what the prognosis is for that neck pain and back pain. So I think that's something that the physical therapy profession is still working towards. I know there's a lot of kind of branding changes and other marketing changes that are going on to kind of put us at the forefront of people's minds when they do have a new onset of back pain or neck pain, or any pain for that matter. But it's, you know, we're still relatively young as a profession. So I think those changes are still coming. But a PT as kind of a first source for help is definitely a good decision based on what the research is showing us.
Mm. I mean, don't worry, you're on the perfect podcast for shameless PT plugs, because we're all about it. And I think that, I know, Tim, you mentioned earlier, like, all PTs aren't created equal and not all sure. PTs practice equal. And I think we've heard it. We've probably all heard it. Oh, I've tried PT before and that didn't work. You know, that'd be very similar to saying, oh, I tried a car mechanic before and they didn't work. So I'm not going to see car mechanics anymore. And how do we go about vetting PTs? Because, you know, we all like to think that there's these turf wars between chiros and PTs and all that. But I know PTs that I probably wouldn't send people to for back pain, because all they're going to do is do different manual work and not really give them any sort of ability to understand how can I do something different in my body to prevent myself from ending up in this situation again. So Tim, do you have any tips on how people can try and vet PTs to know if they're seeing somebody who can actually help them long term?
Yeah, Dom, I think you made a really good point. I think there's amazing chiropractors out there, and there's amazing physical therapists. And at the same time, there's the other side of the coin, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's one of those things that there's sort of the sharks and the jets, if you would, in terms of the turf wars of what's the right practitioner to see. And I think it depends at times. And I think one of the things, I have one patient who one time called me to interview me prior to setting up an appointment. Right. And the patient said, yeah, I checked you out on LinkedIn and checked out a couple of the papers published and have some questions for you before I sign up for an appointment.
Wow.
And it kind of caught me off guard. I was like, really? I have to try to sell my skill set in order for you to come in so I can treat your hip? And at the same time, I truly respected that, because I think we see as a society, and Brian mentioned before, and I'm sure you guys could talk about it for days, the branding difficulty that our profession has, because when you say, I'm going to go to physical therapy, well, what does that actually entail? And I think it's the beauty of the profession also, because we have so many skill sets that we're able to provide, but not everybody understands what those skill sets are. And so I think if I were a patient trying to navigate the healthcare system and trying to figure out who should I be trying to see, one concept could be even just going right to the front desk, calling them and saying, who is the practitioner that treats the most individuals that have low back pain? I think that's probably the most simplistic way of doing it, because there are, like Brian said, certain subspecialties of clinicians that treat predominantly shoulder pain patients or individuals that are having knee impairments. And so if you just get placed on their kind of schedule, I think that's one of the situations that you might need to manage differently. And at the same time, I think even regardless of the clinician's skill set, what type of clinic are you going to? Because not all PTs are created equal. Not all clinics are created equal either. And I think if you're in a facility that is treating five or six other patients at the same time, you're running through your quote unquote home exercise list while you're at PT, and you spend 5 to 10 minutes with a clinician, I don't care if they're necessarily the leading expert in that city or state on back pain. If you're only getting 5 minutes of someone's time and they're distracted by five or six other patients, it's probably not the best experience for you, because there's so many other factors that go into your health and well-being besides back pain. Mm. And I think that's one of the things that having an opportunity to work with a clinician that is giving you their full time and attention, and able to address some of these other social aspects to your health, is probably one of the things you have to take a look at.
Mm, that is so, so true. And honestly, I would say very difficult in the typical sense of I go to a clinic and a lot of times there's so much turnover. And I remember even working as an aide, I loved working as an aide at this place because I got to see so many different people and do so much stuff and help the PTs probably very illegally. And but at the same time, there's so much turnover. I knew myself, even going into PT school, like I will never work at a place like this, because as a PT, there was hardly any time for the therapist to really work with the patient. As an aide, I loved it. I got a lot of experience. I got a lot of turnover. I got a lot of just hands-on with so much stuff. But I think that is very difficult to know, you know, if you're going to be able to, how long you're going to spend with your clinician. And I think that's great to be able to even call up a clinic and say, how long do I get with my therapist? Not with an aide, but with my therapist. And how long are the treatment sessions with that therapist? I think that's great advice, and knowing that people can feel empowered to call around to different places. You don't have to go to the one that your doctor has recommended. You know, there's so many physical therapy practices that, you know, people can just continue to ask around. I think that's so important. But something that is also really important is something I love that you guys do, and Dom kind of mentioned it in the beginning, was talking about language and knowing the difference between words that are potentially causing more harm and words that are really healing. And Brian, can you kind of talk into what that really means and what we need to be aware of as clinicians?
Yeah. So I think we're definitely starting to see kind of a shift in language, at least on the rehab side, but kind of across different healthcare systems and professions, to using a little less threatening language and kind of normalizing a lot of the things that we see and hear about. So the common example most common example would be something like a degenerative disc disease. Mm. Well, why do we call something that's very normal and that all of us over the age of, you know, what have you, 30, probably have some level of, normal age-related changes. So we take this kind of normal age-related condition of discs kind of losing their water content and quote-unquote degenerating, and we put disease on the back end of it, and we put degenerative on the forefront of it.
Yeah.
And so we have degenerative disc disease, and it just sounds terrible. And really what that is a normal progression of aging to some extent, at this point in our lives, and anyone older than us probably has, if you took a picture of their back. But those people, not necessarily all of them have pain, and actually many of them don't. So I think we're starting to see a shift where we're stepping away from, phrases like wear and tear, degenerative, paresthesia, these kind of frightening words, and really calling them what they are. Normal age-related changes, tingling or sensation change, and trying to substitute words in like that to kind of shift it from more of a biomedical kind of approach, which, historically medicine has been rooted in, to more of a biopsychosocial, taking into account the whole person and taking into account normal age-related changes.
How do you start to really kind of deal with someone that is coming to a physical therapy clinic and saying these things because that's what they've been told by their doctor. And for them, it's now fact. This is what it is. This is what I've been told. This is what's happening with my body. And it's very dramatized, but it's because that's what they've been told. So how do we start to shift in their minds what they're understanding to be true versus what is actually happening within their bodies?
Yeah, it's tough because it's such whoever the first contact provider is going to have such a profound influence over what that patient then brings with them to the next provider or to whomever else they speak to, or actually whoever the patient speaks to first about the problem. So that could be a family member, that could be their uncle that had that same problem and had to get X, Y, and Z treatments for it. So it is difficult, but I think it's just kind of choosing words wisely and providing education and context to the with regards to the problem that they're having. So it is tough because things that we might think are things that we say or hear on a daily basis that we might think are innocuous and harmless can have a profound influence on the patient or the person seeking help based on what they hear and whom else they have spoken to.
And I think sort of continuing with that, when I think back to our physical therapy education, even back in 2014, there was this lack of, I'd say, appreciation for communication with word choice, and the pain science sort of takeoff wasn't really there just yet. We were sort of on the cusp of it. And so I think what's a challenge right now is that pain science is one of the hot topics in physical therapy. And so all these young students and young professionals that are coming out and practicing have all this awesome knowledge rooted in facts and rooted in evidence and are so excited to implement it on patients. But at the same time, like you were saying, this is something that these emotions, this diagnosis sort of holds true to their heart. And I think providing education without asking for permission is one of the downfalls of a lot of practitioners. And so if I were to believe something and I believed it as true and all my family members told me this was true, and I just met you and I'm kind of running between patients and I got another patient in 10 minutes and I'm telling you that you are wrong, the degenerative disc disease is actually a normal common tissue change, which is rooted in evidence, right? It's like gray hairs on the inside. We're all going to get them. It's like wrinkles on our skin, right? So even though it's true, one of the things that I try to be really mindful of is asking, would you be interested in learning more about this? I understand what you are saying, and that sounds very threatening or challenging. And just trying to have more of a active listening style. And sort of, I guess a buzzword would be motivationally interview a patient to allow for them to start to ask the questions versus me being the practitioner from a patriarchal model standpoint, providing all of the answers for them. The more questions they ask, the more willing they're going to be to accept the information.
I love that you bring that up because I think we just recently had another PT that brought that same thing up. And I can think back to being that young, rambunctious provider out there trying to solve everyone's misnomers and myths that they've been believing their whole lives. And and it made me think like, wow, I really should have, backpedaled in some of those moments. But also just now bringing up motivational interviewing, that was probably one of my favorite when I started seeing more courses on motivational interviewing and learning more about what that was and how to really invite that patient into that educational process rather than just dumping it on top of them. That's so important. And I think after all the things that we've been talking about, we really kind of run into what is the catch-22 of where our health system and medical system is at, where, we're now wanting to ask providers to provide a bunch more of a bunch more education and take some more time to be able to ask patients if they want to have this education and deliver it, even though they may have been getting these other phrases or diagnoses spoken to them for the past 10, 20, 30 years. And then we have a whole nother half of the medical profession that, you don't want to say they're rooted in their ways, but they've been doing things for a long time. And it takes a long time to educate and promote change in providers who might, have a way of doing things, and they may even be open to learning, but it still takes time to change some of these things. And then we also have a great majority of our country that they may have one PT clinic within 20 or 30 minutes of them and only have one provider who does, you know, does things in a certain way. So how can a patient who might be in middle America, you know, I'm from more small town Minnesota, we were lucky to have access to at least a couple hospitals nearby, but if they only have one provider and they're noticing, oh, wow, that's kind of how my provider talks. And it seems like he just tells me what's going on in my body and I feel scared walking out of all these appointments. Like, what should somebody in that type of situation do?
I think one of the things I always recommend for my patients to do prior to any sort of medical appointment is write down the list of questions that you need the answers to. Right. And I think that's one of the things that whether it's a job interview or you're meeting up with somebody for the first time, we forget things as soon as we think about them.
Yeah.
And especially when we're in the healthcare sort of setting where the doctor might be running 20 minutes late as they're already understaffed and they have so many patients, especially in today's day and age. And there's so many other things like you were mentioning, Dom, we're not even having the conversation about the pandemic. Right, we're just talking about traditional musculoskeletal situations, but now there's screening and temperature checks and all these other questions that have to be asked. So our healthcare system is exhausted at this point. And so for the practitioner coming in and let's say you have back pain, you slept weird and your back hurts or you moved as you're picking up this box in a slightly different direction. And for you, that is novel. And it is serious for the practitioner. And they might say, yeah, you strained your back, right? And they might see that pattern recognition and already be out the door onto the next patient. But they still have to respect the fact that this is your first experience or this is your experience in general. And I think that's one of the things that we as clinicians sometimes oversee because we get into this pattern recognition or in this mindset that, oh, that's not that big of a deal. But to the patient, it's a huge deal. Yeah. And so I think one of the things that I would do as a patient would be, I want to know this answer, this question, what's going on. If they answer this question, what's the follow-up question? And I really, when my patients go follow-up with an orthopedic postoperatively or just checking with their general practitioner, I will write those questions for them so that they feel like they have some guidance as to what needs to be asked. And then I say, don't leave until you have the answers, because I think you as a patient deserves that time and deserve to understand what's going on with your body.
I think that's so important. And just empowering someone to be able to ask those questions. I mean, I remember even, you know, recently my family kind of going into medical stuff and I prepared a list of questions with my mom. Okay, here's what you're going to ask. Here's what's going to happen. You know, and just having that other outside perspective too of what questions should I ask, and having maybe a family member or a friend who knows a little bit more about the system or can help guide you in that, like asking for support as you're going through something that you don't know about within your body. I think that's so incredibly valuable. Now, I know that we've kind of touched on some things with back pain and we've kind of thrown some terms around that people might may or may not recognize. But in general, I mean, I think I've heard you guys say, you know, get treated earlier. So if you start feeling it, go see a physical therapist before. What are some other, you know, tools that you can kind of provide people that are currently in back pain and Googling and scrolling through my Instagram to try to find relief? Like, what are some things that you can kind of guide, kind of help guide people toward who are in back pain?
I think just like from a real basic standpoint, then I'll let Brian throw in his two cents, is movement is so important, right? And I think that's one of the things that a body in motion stays in motion. And you can talk about motion is lotion and all these other buzzwords. But I think that there's a societal impression that my back hurts, I'm going to go lay down on the couch. I'm going to put my feet up. Oh, I threw my back out this past weekend. I'm going to lie here for the next 2 or 3 days. And while movement may not necessarily feel great, there's probably a movement that you could comfortably do. And so I think something as simple as walking after an acute onset or a recent onset of back pain that does seem relatively severe, that can be significantly valuable in terms of just getting movement and blood flow to tissues. and trying to desensitize your nervous system. And so I think something as simple as walking, I know that's not necessarily going to be the most extravagant Instagram post for you, Jen, if you want to post that later, but walking, breathing, and understanding that back pain is a common thing. It's like death, taxes, and back pain. It's going to happen to you at some point in time. And understanding that it is a common thing, commonplace, and it does get better over time. And so I think keeping a positive attitude and staying moving in that time while you're trying to navigate the healthcare system and trying to figure out who's the right practitioner for you to go see would be my sort of 2 cents of advice.
Yeah, if somebody, you know, is kind of looking online, searching for information, I would like for them to understand. I usually have this conversation with my patients that have kind of a new onset of back pain or any other pain is nobody likes pain. Nobody wakes up in the morning saying, oh man, yeah, I'm going to give myself some good pain today. It's going to be a great day, right? Nobody likes it, but pain is really all about protection. So after any type of injury or just kind of acute onset, waking up with, you know, pain in the neck or pain in the back, it's really your body is trying to protect you and it's trying to tell you to do certain things. So kind of just piggybacking off of what Tim said, generally, some movements are going to be uncomfortable, but there are always going to be some positions or movements that are comfortable and you are able to do, assuming this is, you know, kind of a sprain, strain, or musculoskeletal in nature. There's always going to be something that you can do. So whether that is walking, whether that is biking, whether for some that might be getting in a pool and swimming to be kind of, you know, non-weight bearing and non-loading. Pick your poison. It's, you know, motion is lotion and movement kind of gets the joints going, gets blood flow and oxygen to the muscles and the tissues and kind of calms down the alarm system, if you will. So after kind of any acute onset, the alarm system, which is your kind of, you know, your pain awareness, we'll say, is very sensitive. And it's all about kind of calming things down, recognizing that this will get better and kind of turning down the alarm system, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And then I think just one more thing, Jen, they've done so many studies recently in terms of like, what's the best kind of exercise for you to be doing for individuals with low back pain. So let's say you're not one of these acute patients that Brian and I are talking about, and you're trying to figure out what would be valuable in order to get you back to sport or get you back to some of the extracurricular activities that you want to see. And we put all this time and attention on some of these fine motor exercises where we're really analyzing pelvic tilt posture or stability of the spine, quote unquote, which would be one of those words that I would not use in front of a patient. But they've done these studies and they show that general exercise oftentimes has the same clinical outcomes as these real specific low load, real basic, quote unquote, core based programs. Mm-hmm. And so I think understanding that strength training, moving, doing something active, doing something that you like, and sort of reiterating what Brian said, something that's not necessarily aggravating your symptoms, or if it does aggravate your symptoms, it's only for a short duration of time, is going to allow for the body to make adaptation. And so I think it's one of those things that, yes, there might be a more specialized program. They've done some studies where they show that a more individualized, specific exercise, if you would, program is going to cause better outcomes, especially if it's matched to you. Because like we said back in the beginning, back pain is not a cookbook. And so you can't necessarily just provide, you're going to do a 30-second plank, you're going to do a couple crunches, and you're going to be all set. It's not going to necessarily work that way because those might not be the right quote unquote exercises for that patient.
I think all of those were such valuable little sound bites that we can take out of this and blast out to people just because, I mean, I personally know that if I have something and my back starts hurting that I'll get better a heck of a lot faster if I go out and kayak for a half an hour than sit on the ground and do dead bugs or something like that, just because I enjoy it so much more. And yes, if it's not aggravating to me, it's going to be activating a lot of muscles around my body and core and torso. And I love it. And if I tell myself if I tell myself, hey, if I keep moving, I'm going to feel better. My mind's going to be happy. My body's going to be feeling it. My body's going to be activating muscles and boom. Back pain is going to start to go down. So lots of great things that you guys said right there. I did want to bring up, I know that not too long ago, y'all put out a book, Movers and Mentors. And I know that this is more geared potentially towards the clinician and might include some of the things we've been chatting about today. But Brian, could you just talk a little bit about what was the inspiration for the book? Why put it out?
Yeah, definitely. Back when Tim and I were going through residency, we were, you know, reading a lot of research and consuming a lot of content, physical therapy specific content. And we started seeing a lot of the same names coming up, researchers, innovators, business leaders, within all of this content that we were consuming. And we were also, you know, at that time also had a lot of questions both personally and professionally about what our next steps were and what the right track was for us. So we were reading Tim Ferriss's book, Tools of Titans, at the time, which, you know, Tim Ferriss interviews a bunch of really kind of large figures like Arnold Schwarzenegger, Tony Robbins, Brene Brown, really kind of influential people. And so, you know, Tim and I looked at one another one day and we said, well, wouldn't it be great if, you know, physical therapists had a book like this, interviewing some of the leaders in our profession and, you know, thought leaders, innovators, influencers. So we kicked that idea around for a little bit. And then in 2018, we kind of drew up a master list of individuals we would want to interview and came up with some questions that we thought young professionals and students would be interested in. And then we sent out our first emails in 2018. And since then, we've been working on it and, yeah, just published it in October.
Amazing. Congratulations, y'all, for creating something that wasn't already out there and can help a lot of students, people thinking about the profession, people in the profession currently, and just being able to get different perspectives. Because I think there could be a lot of judgment based on what I do or based on what Kelly Charette does. And I've even been in, which I think is ridiculous, I've been in PT courses, CEU courses, and people are kind of making fun of Kelly or something and some of the work he's done. And I just think, how sad. Look at what an innovator, someone who's put us on the market and someone who's created such an incredible platform for us to continue to be seen by the general population. You know, we need to be supporting each other and building each other up and saying, how can we learn from one another? And that's what you guys have kind of brought into this book, which I think is just so, so incredible. Like, Tim, what are you hoping kind of comes out of this book?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the really good points that you bring up, Jen. When we sort of created this quote unquote master list or this dream team, of which you made the cut. So congratulations.
you were in my opening. Thank you, Jen, for being a part of our book.
Thank you.
But I mean, I think it's one of those things that there's over 75 individuals within the book. And so you're going to get a variety of different input. You're going to get a variety of different thoughts. And what I think is really helpful are the questions that we ask. And so we ask questions about what's good advice within the profession? What's bad advice within the profession? If you were going to give advice to a young graduate, what do you think they want to hear? And I think one of the most important ones that I think is valuable for not only physical therapy students or health professional students, but people in general, is the conversation about failure. And I think when we look back and Dom, Jen, you could probably confirm within your graduating classes in PT school, the majority of the people in the class are type A personalities who like to succeed. Mm-hmm. When they get a grade below a 90, sort of they shut down and they think they're not going to necessarily gonna be able to graduate because we do not handle failure well. And from a societal standpoint, no one signs up and says, yeah, I'm going to fail really bad today. That's going to be my goal for the day. We always like to succeed. And I think one of the biggest things that I hope that comes out of this book and that I've been able to see some of my students come up and talk to me about is this concept of the normalization of failure. Mm. And there's guests within this book that talk about failing clinical rotations. They talk about failing their board's exams. And then there's individuals that share other failures, personal failures, big life failures, failures that when we look at them as a whole, we would think could possibly traumatize somebody. But understanding that these failures allowed for this person to grow and you're able to read about the growth within the pages, I think is going to be really helpful for this next generation of clinicians.
So much Jen, so agree with that.
Yeah, Jen, you mentioned something just about, you know, kind of our profession. And yeah, I agree. It is unfortunate when there's like different camps and, you know, so-and-so is doing what or treating under this paradigm or philosophy. But, you know, everyone in our book is pushing the profession forward. To bring it full circle, we had that conversation about physical therapy and physical therapists kind of having a branding issue and a kind of a marketing issue. Well, we need, you know, people like you, Jen and Dom, kind of putting our message out there, putting physical therapy at the forefront of people's minds to get them to think movement and motion first and not anything else, not any of that other, you know, I'm not going to call it harmful, but not any of those other treatments that they don't need to go there yet. So I think, you know, what you guys are doing is awesome, and you guys are having a huge impact on profession and society in general. And we need more of that. So even though everyone's kind of going about it, at least within our book, the guests are going about it in different ways, whether that's research, whether that's business, whether that's innovating and influencing, you know, everyone's trying to, has the same goal at heart. So, you know, thank you for the work that you guys are doing. And we hope that the book is valuable to those that read it.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you saying that. And I appreciate that message always, that like there's no time in my mind for turf wars in medicine in general. I just think that there's too many people out there that need help. There's too many people out there that are in pain for us to be sitting around wasting our time trying to tear down other professions or other factions from within our own profession. That's time wasted. That's time that we could be spending on trying to figure out how to do it better, how to serve our people better that we come in contact with. Not waste our time on other professionals that we think are doing it wrong. Yeah, there's always a better way to do it. And there's always a better way for me to do it. And if I don't look at anyone who does things differently than myself and try to learn something small from them and take that away and say, wow, I think they do that really well. Yeah, maybe I don't agree with a few other things that they do, but I can take that and integrate it into what I do. That's a win.
Yeah.
If I sit there and try to focus on the things I don't agree with, shame on me, you know? And so I love this concept of this book that y'all have put together. Where can somebody go and try to find this if they're looking to get it, either as a professional themselves, or I'm guessing there's a ton of stuff that would be valuable in there for the general population even.
Yeah. So our book, you can find it on Amazon. You can just search Movers and Mentors on Amazon, or you can go to moversandmentors.com. And we have some information about the book there. We have a list of guests. We have a sample. If you want to kind of look through some of the answers of some of our guests, and there's also a link to Amazon there as well. We're also on Instagram and Twitter if you want to follow us on there.
Amazing. And we'll definitely have that all linked up. And I'm just very honored that I even made the cut. So thank you. This whole platform thing has just been a crazy ride since it started, and can't believe I'm here, and I'm honored that I was a part of that. So thank you guys.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
And there we have it, yet another amazing guest on the Optimal Body Podcast. So now what we ask of you, if you loved any bit of that or resonated with it, go share it out, share it with a friend, share it on your social media, because you know there are more people out there that would resonate with it just the same. Also, subscribe, rate, review on your favorite podcast app so we know what you want to learn or other guests that you think we should bring on for you in the future. Keep tuning in to find your optimal body.